Hi, welcome to Visual Studio Toolbox. I'm your host, Robert Green, and with me today from the Entity Framework team are Rowan Miller and Glenn Condren. Hi, guys.
Good to see you again.
Rowan is back. It's been over a year since Diego were on to talk about Entity Framework.
Yeah, pre-EF 5 days.
And there's been a couple things that have happened since then. Mm-hmm. Entity Framework 5 was released to much fanfare, and 6 is on its way.
Yeah, coming out soon.
It's in preview now, and so we had a request from a viewer that we get you back and get you guys back and update on what's going on with Entity Framework, and you're here.
Absolutely. One of the other things that's happened since then is we had Glenn join our team. So he's fresh into the PM role, working on EF6. So it's been good.
Okay, so back by popular demand.
Absolutely.
And the first episode that you did, you and Diego did, over 100,000 views, was the number one Toolbox episode until it was supplanted by the Visual Studio 2012 Update 2 episode, if I'm not mistaken.
Very good. Hopefully we can claim the title back this time around.
Yeah. Or was it the 2013 preview episode? I forget which one it was, but one of those. Supplanted it. So we'll try and get the crown back today.
Sounds good.
All right.
So I thought we could start by just kind of recapping where we've been, where we're at now, and kind of looking forwards into the future in terms of versions, and then dig into some features of 5 and 6.
Cool.
Sound right? So most folks know this. Entity Framework's been around in the .NET framework since .NET 3.5 Service Pack 1. So in 3.5 Service Pack 1 and .NET 4, the runtime was part of the .NET framework and the tooling was part of Visual Studio.
Right.
When we released EF4, a lot of great features in there, but we had a lot more features we wanted to add, and it had been 2 years between those two releases. So that's really slow if you're waiting for new features. So we started at looking at how we could get features into customers' hands quicker. So for the next lot of releases, which is kind of where we were last time we talked, 4.1, 4.2, 4.3, 5, we did this kind of hybrid model where the core components of EF were still inside the .NET framework, but the new components we were adding, like the DB Context API, which is the simplified API surface, and Code First chipped out of band on NuGet. And our tooling was still part of Visual Studio.
Right.
We made one not very good attempt at doing an out-of-band release of the tooling, the 2011 June CGP of Death and Destruction, we call it on our team. Went horribly. Our product just wasn't set up for shipping out-of-band.
Okay.
Now, this model was good because it let us ship features, but it's also super confusing. And this really showed through when we got to EF5 and we had, you know, enums and spatial performance improvements. But a lot of those required changes in the .NET framework. And so to use those features, you could use EF5, but you had to be targeting .NET 4.5. And so you could use EF5 on .NET 4, but you missed half the features, and it just wasn't a good spot to be. So we kind of bit the bullet, and going from 5 to 6 has been a big release for us. So we've taken basically all the runtime and made it out of band. So we took the parts that were in the .NET framework and moved them into our NuGet package.
Uh-huh.
Now, obviously, we can't actually delete things from the .NET framework. So when we say we moved them, we actually took a copy of them, put them in a new namespace, and we're going to dig into what that actually means when we get to the EF6 part of today.
Okay, because then that begs the question, if you reference them in the .NET framework namespace versus the EF runtime namespace, what happens?
Yeah, absolutely. So we didn't want to delete things. We don't want to break people's applications.
Sure.
So if you have a dependency on what's in .NET, it's still there. Mm-hmm. But if you want to use EF6, then we're going to talk a bit more about how to do that.
Okay.
We also took the tooling out of band. So no real functional changes here. We just did a whole bunch of infrastructure work, you know, working on the way we install, uninstall, upgrade, the ways we interact with the version of the runtime that the user has in their project that just allowed us to ship the tooling out of band.
So you did that originally because there was a long lag between releases of Visual Studio and the .NET framework. Now Visual Studio is releasing essentially quarterly with the quarterly updates, and 2013 is shipping a year after 2012. So does that take away some of the benefit, or does it just give you more flexibility?
Yeah, well, so definitely we want to be included in Visual Studio. I'll talk about that in a second. That's very important for us, is shipping with Visual Studio. Mm-hmm. But what we love in the 4.3 kind of time frame, we were shipping previews like once every 3 to 6 weeks.
Okay.
And we love being able to do that. But going forwards, being in the box with Visual Studio, not everyone can go and download the greatest thing from NuGet. Not everyone can hop on Download Center and install new tooling. A lot of enterprises will like bless the Visual Studio install, and then folks have to work within those parameters.
Right.
So while we do ship out of band in between releases, when VS releases, it will have the latest and greatest version of EFM.
Okay.
So one example being VS 2013 will have EF6 and EF6 tooling in the box.
Yeah. Right.
The other big advantage you get is like with when we're in this blue area here, you have things that work only on specific versions of .NET Framework. So like any framework 5 will work on .NET 4.5 or .NET 4. But you won't get enum support unless you're targeting .NET 4.5. Whereas because we're not in the .NET framework, in Entity Framework 6, you'll get all Entity Framework features on .NET 4 or .NET 4.5 or going forward. So
okay.
In EF6, you're going to get features that previously you had to target a specific version of the framework for. So now that we're out of the framework, we can say, we'll add a feature to the runtime, and that'll work on all the supported .NET frameworks.
Would you expect the supported frameworks would be the one prior, the two prior? Do you have a sense of that?
We don't really have a hard and fast rule yet. I mean, particularly at the moment where we're seeing kind of cumulative updates to .NET 4, we'll certainly support that base going forwards. There are going to be some cases, like in .NET 4.5, we introduced the async and await keywords, so support for those in EF, you do need to target 4.5 to get them.
Sure.
But for the most part, we're kind of treating .NET 4 as the baseline at the moment.
So. Cool.
Great.
So here we're going to talk a little bit about the developer workflows. If any of you, I'm sure Rowan showed this last time in the talk that he done, and every talk that I've ever done on any framework and he's done has showed this, but there's still a lot of confusion around it, so we'd like to sort of open with this to help people out. So because there's so many different ways you can use Entity Framework, but really what they end up boiling down to is two fundamental questions. The first one, which you don't really have any control over, is have I got a new database or am I trying to target an existing database? Right, so that's going to be made for you. So the question that you have to ask yourself when you're a developer and you want to use Entity Framework is, do I prefer boxes and lines in a designer type world, or do I prefer the code first, I just want to write some code kind of world? So if we fill in these boxes, what we have is, if you're targeting a new database and you like the designer and the boxes and lines, well then this is the very early way of using Entity Framework with model first, where you create a model in the design surface and then you generate some SQL and you create your database and away you go. Then there's also, you can use five of the tooling, you can reverse engineer your EDMX model, your designer model. And so that's your database first kind of scenario. Then after that, we introduced this code first way of working with the world. And in it, and all of the demos we showed and everything showed, you created some classes, then via convention, and we'll just automatically go and create a database for you, and we'll do all this magic for you, and it looks fantastic. Now, one of the big reasons for this slide is that this next box is the one that always gets missed, which is that you can use code first to talk to an existing database. Right? You just have your existing database. You can use the power tools to reverse engineer a code first model from an existing database, or you could just write some classes to represent your tables and then do some mappings to get back, give Entity Framework the connection string, and it'll happily use your existing database instead of, you don't have to create a new one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think we're a little bit guilty here too of kind of pushing the image that code first is the way of the future and the design is a bit outdated, because all our demos, code first is just super easy to use. So we were talking about that, and today we're going to do all our demos using the EF Designer just to show that, you know, we can show new features using the EF Designer. We are working on it. So.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. Yeah, code first doesn't supplant the designer by any means. They're both viable options.
Yeah, absolutely. So I thought we'd take the first section, we'll talk about some of the stuff in EF5, show some demos, and then after that we'll swap to EF6 and talk about that and then show some demos.
But before you do that, you have to explain iHeart Unicorn, is that what that is?
It is. So back in the EF4.1 days, we released the Microsoft ADO.NET Entity Framework Community Technology Preview 1 or something like this, which was a horrible name. Mm-hmm. Scott Hanselman didn't like the name, but he loved the content, so he dubbed it Entity Framework Magic Unicorn Edition, and it kind of stuck since then. We've had people have made backdrops
magic
for your
unicorn,
computer.
Not
we've
just
had,
a unicorn, magic
absolutely,
unicorn.
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay.
He said that MEF Magical Unicorn Edition means as much as what that name does, because the name didn't mean anything.
So we liked that name better, so we went with it. So we've had t-shirts and stickers and all the rest. We embraced it fully. So EF5, that we quickly run through some of the features, and then we'll dig in and see them in action. So these ones apply to both Code First and the EF Designer. So support for enums, people have been screaming for that since EF was first released. Spatial data types, geography, geometry data in your application, and then some good performance improvements. These performance improvements are mostly around runtime. So once your application's up and running, how quick is it to query data from the database, et cetera. And then some features apply only to the EF Designer. So DB context has kind of been around since 4.1 as the default way of doing code first. could do object context, but DB context was kind of the mainline scenario. Mm-hmm. In EF5, we made it also the mainline scenario for the designer. Diagrams and coloring on the designer, and the ability to map to table value functions in the database. So that's enough of intro. Let's go see some of it in action. So I'm going to swap over to Visual Studio. To demo these features, we're going to build an MVC application. And I thought I'd just start with the basic template. So while we're creating the application, we're going to use the EF Designer to an existing database. So I thought I'd just quickly show you the schema we're mapping to. This schema that we're mapping to kind of centers around the idea of a listing, which is a house or a piece of property that's for sale. From that, we have this many-to-many relationship with points of interest. So an example of this might be, you know, I'm close by a school or I'm close by some good coffee shops, et cetera, to kind of help move the property. Points of interest have a type. It might be a park, might be a coffee shop, et cetera. And then we also capture the photos of our listings.
Right.
Then we kind of have this separate part of our model where we track, you know, the selling agent for a listing. We can capture a photo of the agent, and we capture the company that the agent works for. Okay. So we're going to go to the models folder in our MVC app, and we're going to add an ADO.NET entity data model. We're going to generate from an existing database. We'll connect to our local DB instance.
The only person I know that remembers the connection string.
And then one of the new features you'll see in the EF5 designer, it also works in the EF6 designer, is we started grouping things by schema. So if you have a database with multiple schemas, it's now much easier to say, I just want the sales schema and maybe a couple of tables from DBO or something. So we're just going to pick everything in DBO except for sys diagrams. And we'll hit finish and, you know.
Does anyone ever include sys diagrams?
You could, maybe if you're writing a tool to help look at your diagrams, perhaps. But typically, no. We actually did talk about filtering out the kind of system tables, but you know, some people may want to write an application that visualizes their database, so we wanted to make it possible to map to these things.
Yeah, it'd be easy to take them out, but then you have to provide a way to for people to get it. So it's probably just easier to let it in there. It doesn't really hurt your model if you leave it in there.
Absolutely,
it
just sits there.
And it's a lot of work and testing to do to then add the way to get it that's not immediately obvious. So.
Yeah. And it's not immediately obvious is the problem.
Yeah.
Right.
All right, so we've got a base application up and running. Let's talk through some features and show them in action. So DB context code gen. DB context came around in EF4.1. It was possible to use it with the EF designer, but it wasn't kind of built in by default. Mm-hmm. It was definitely the way to use it if you're going code first route. We just built the DB context API. It's like a simpler, more intuitive introduction to EF. It's not a replacement of object context. It's a simpler experience over the top of object context.
It's a wrapper.
Exactly, yeah. So one of the things we found, object context API was very powerful, but the APIs were complicated. And a lot of the reasons they were complicated was to support scenarios that, you know, maybe 1% of developers do. Mm-hmm. So we tried to kind of hide all that away with DB context, make it easy to do common things.
And you can still get to it if you need to. You can always still get to object context from DB context, because they're the same.
So creating a new model in the EF5 designer and EF6, you'll get DB context by default. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we don't want to automatically upgrade existing models because that would break your application. But if you want to, you can opt in, you know, switch the code generation templates on for DB context. We'll start generating DB context, and you'd have to make some minor application tweaks to use it.
Are there any tools to convert object to DB if that's what you want?
There aren't at the moment. Basically, for the common set of APIs, it's kind of a one-to-one mapping. You know, we had add object, you know, on object set, which is part of object context, but you know, everybody else in the .NET framework just calls it add. So DB set on DB context, it's called add. So you might go change a few names of methods. And if you're doing anything advanced with object context, basically the object context is exposed as a property on DB context. So very easy to drill down if you need it.
Okay.
All right, so to kind of show you what this looks like, let's just look at the code being generated here. So under our model.edmx, we see there's a nested 2TT file. So we have model.tt and model.context.tt. TT is just text transform. It's a T4 code generator. So we're using something that's already widely available. If we look at the context file, this is vastly different than what it used to look like. With object context, potentially hundreds of lines of code in here. with a new DB context API, very simple.
Right.
So we're trying to keep the code simple.
Which also keeps the template simple. So for anybody who's trying to modify the templates to do something custom.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Looking at the classes, you see we now have a file for each class. And if we look at, say, listing, it's just a very simple Poco class. This should be very simple to what you'd write yourself if you were trying to write this class. Okay. So that's DB context. I mentioned multiple diagrams and coloring. So this is just being able to split the model up either visually on one canvas or being able to split models up into multiple canvases. Mm. Two places to use this. One is if you have a model that has a lot of entities in it. You know, this one canvas can get very unwieldy. You know, you're scrolling in and out, you're panning a lot, it's very complicated.
Right.
The other one, if you have a model that has distinct sections, which is the situation we find ourselves in. We have like 6 or 7 entities in our model, but we kind of have the listing section and the agent section. So it'd be nice to be able to differentiate those two. So going back to VS, if we load up our model, and I'll probably just zoom out a little bit to help us out here. So we've got the agent photo, the agent, and the company. So if I bring up the properties for those, I could just go and apply some coloring to help me kind of differentiate between them on the design surface. If I had a bigger model, I might want to actually split this out into a separate diagram. So there's many ways to create diagrams, but the easiest one is to select the entities we want, just right-click and move to a new diagram. Okay, and we see here over in Model Browser, we now have a diagrams folder with 2 diagrams under it. And, you know, we spit these entities onto it.
So diagram 1 now no longer has those and diagram 2 does?
Correct, yeah. Now, on diagram 1, we might actually want to have the agent entity here because having the selling agent could make sense in the context of this diagram. So we can put it back on. We just expand entities and drag it on. So an entity can be on 0 or more diagrams.
Okay.
Makes sense,
so a nice feature request that you can think of in the future would be away from a diagram to see that there's entities in a different diagram and then maybe some kind of peak capability or
virtual switching between diagrams.
Yeah, because if I just open up diagram 1, now I don't know about agent. If I split them myself and I'm familiar with the structure, then I certainly do. But if I'm not coming to work on this project for the first time, where's my hint that agent is associated with listing?
Yeah, there's a very subtle hint here, which is that we see the navigation property, so we can guess from this that there's some other stuff this is related to. But I take your point. It's very subtle hint. So. Okay, so moving on to enums. Enums, obviously a very common thing to use when you're writing classes. EF just didn't natively support them, and it kind of sat around in the top 10 on our backlog and bubbled its way to the top, and we finally implemented them to much applause, but also much finally. It's pretty obvious when you should use them. Enums lend themselves to properties that have a well-defined set of types. I should also point out, if you have existing enums that you want to use in your model, you can totally use those as well. So let's go use one. The part in our model that lends itself well to enums is we have a point of interest which has a point of interest type. We mentioned that's a table in our database, but it probably has some pretty static data in it.
Right.
So we can basically get rid of the entity off our design surface. And then I'm going to click on what used to be the foreign key to that entity and select convert to enum. And let's just call it point type, can be the name of the enum. And we might have, say, parks could be 1. Businesses might be 2, we might have a food listing for 3, and so on and so forth. Now, I just wanted to point out here too, there is this reference external type checkbox. So I don't have an enum to use, so I want it to generate one for me. But if I had an external enum, then I could select this box and tell it which enum to use, and it wouldn't generate the code.
Okay.
So let's just hit OK on that.
So you used to be using a table, now you're using an enum, so you'd have to make sure they stay in sync?
Yeah, absolutely. Now, a common feature request is kind of a take this entity and convert it into an enum. So we'd go and look at the data in the table and generate an enum based on the data.
Right, some kind of sync functionality.
Yeah.
I guess you'd have the ability to make it a two-way sync if you had write writes to that table, but you'd at least want to read one-way sync.
Absolutely. Now, that kind of two-way sync going from the model to the database one, Code First, we have a really great migration story. In the model, in the EF Designer, we don't at the moment.
Right.
So that is the kind of things we could look at with migrations in the EF Designer.
Right.
Cool. All right, so let's just quickly look at the code that was generated. If we go to Solution Explorer, we'll see there's a new point type getting generated now. So again, mm-hmm. it's a very simple enum, probably what we'd expect to write ourselves.
Right.
And if we look at point of interest, we'll see that the point of interest type ID, which used to be an integer foreign key, is now cool. of the type of our mm-hmm. enum.
That also saves and performs. You don't have to bring down that data.
Yeah. The other one that's great is when you're writing queries. If you wanted to bring back, you know, all points of interest that are of type food, mm-hmm. then it's much easier to do a where clause where the type ID equals point type dot food instead
right.
of where type ID equals 3, just to
yes,
pull it out of your.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. So spatial data types. Many databases, SQL Server included, support spatial data, the mm-hmm. idea of geography and geometry. What's really great about native support in the database, it allows us to write SQL to actually interrogate that. So we could say, you know, give me all points of interest that are within 5 kilometers of the property that's for sale. Mm-hmm. Now, I could pull all of the points of interest into memory and do the calculation there, but that's pretty inefficient. Being able to push that to the database is great.
Right.
The other thing that's great by supporting spatial data types is the whole point of using an ORM like EF is so that you're writing your code in terms of objects, not in terms of SQL, et cetera.
Right.
So we now have like a nice strongly typed object-oriented experience over geographic data.
Cool.
So to demonstrate spatial data types, I'm actually going to just scaffold out a controller quickly. So I need to build the app to do that. We're going to add a controller. This controller is going to be for the listings in our model. So we want a scaffold based it on the listing class and the real estate entity. So that's the DB context that was generated for us. So I mentioned that it's nice that we ship in the box with VS. One of the things that's good is that all the tooling can integrate together. Mm-hmm. So you may have noticed I didn't actually add entity framework to this project. It's because the default MVC templates pull in EF5.
Right.
Now obviously when we get to VS 2013, you create a new MVC app, you're going to get EF6 by default. So mm-hmm. it's just nice that by shipping in Visual Studio, we can pull all the products together and ship a cohesive story.
Right.
Yeah. All right, so folks have probably seen this before. We scaffolded out.
So we'll, let me ask a question. Will
yeah.
MVC4 ever pull EF6?
No, but you can upgrade yourself. Now,
okay.
you need to be careful because EF6, we kind of took this one-time set of kind of breaking changes or moving the types.
Yeah.
Some legacy things won't actually work with EF6 because they try and access. You know, they might pick up a property mm-hmm. on DB context expecting it to be the type from the framework, but now instead it's actually the type that's now
okay.
out of band in any
right.
framework. So things like MVC4 scaffolding don't work with EF6. But you can scaffold with EF5 and then upgrade to EF6.
We can upgrade this one to EF6 in a little bit. So
okay.
yeah.
at least show you how to upgrade this
Got it.
App to
it. Okay.
So like I was saying, most folks have seen this. We scaffold out a nice controller that, you know, knows about how to use entity framework. It's generated a whole bunch of code for us. We could edit it, but for us, it's fine.
Mm-hmm.
What I do want to do is go to the details view. So this is, we've looked at a list of listings. We've picked a listing we want to look at. And we go to that view. It's just going to display a list of text data that tells us about the listing. But what we'd love to do is display a Bing map that kind of centers
yeah.
on that listing and then drops a point of interest as pins around it. So to do that, I'm going to pull in some code I wrote earlier and then just walk you through what it's doing. So the first thing I've got here is a div, which is basically where the Bing map is going to be displayed. I'm pulling in the Bing Maps API and jQuery, because
mm-hmm.
we're going to make use of those. And then we've got some JavaScript that runs once the page is loaded. So you can see here we're pulling the latitude and longitude out of our model. This is what I mentioned with a nice strongly typed API.
Mm-hmm.
We can just dot straight through things, get IntelliSense on it, et cetera. We create a map. You can see here that it's centered on the coordinates of the listing we're displaying. We add a pin, this orange pin, for the listing. And then we kind of for each, again, this is all nicely strongly typed.
Cool.
We get, you know, IntelliSense, compile time, type checking, et cetera. We go and add some green pins around it for each of the locations.
Right.
And I've just got a nice little helper method here to help me out. Now, because I'm using the geography types within my page, I need to add a using statement or a kind of import in my web.config. So I come down to the compilation section in System Web. I'm just going to drag in a reference here. This is basically letting us know that we're using types from System Data Entity.
Okay.
In our case, it's DB Geography from System Data Entity, and we're using that in our page. So with that done, we can save and run. And I'm going to navigate to the listings controller. So this should give us a list of all the listings. And if we go to the details view of one of them, we see the details that were there by default, but then we see our Bing map centered on the one that's for sale. So Glenn and I are furiously trying to sell Microsoft buildings for a bit of cash.
So what are the points of interest there?
So we have a couple of nice parks nearby. We have the Microsoft Conference Center. I'm quite partial to parks, so we actually have a lot of parks all over the place here.
Oh, but you skipped Merrimore, the big park.
We did, yeah. Yeah.
You can see Merrimore, it's okay.
Yeah.
You don't need a pin for that. There you go.
So my point here is this is obviously a very simple application, but this doesn't take a long time to do. Like Glenn and I just sat down.
How much do you want for building one, by the way?
Well, they're so difficult. Honestly, it takes so long. No, really. Like Glenn and I threw this together really quickly. Uh-huh. You know, you don't. It's not rocket science to use this kind of geography, map, et cetera, data. Right. Now. Yeah. It's great. So.
Certainly makes how far away is this thing calculations a lot easier.
Yeah.
Since you don't have to do the calculation.
Cool. So that's kind of what we wanted to cover for EF5. You know, EF5's been out for a while. Mm-hmm. Folks are pretty familiar with it. We thought we'd spend a bit of time with EF6 now.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right.
Cool. So I started working about the same time we started to ramp up on Entity Framework 6. And this is a part of Entity Framework I know the most about. The first thing we're going to talk about is open sourcing of Entity Framework. So when we had that slide earlier that showed the various stages of sort of the life of Entity Framework, we got into the EF6 part at the top. At the same time as we moved everything out of the .NET framework, we also made all of it open source. So if you go to entityframework.coplex.com, then you can get all of the source code for Entity Framework, everything. Mm-hmm. But you can also get all of the nightly builds are available on the ASP, the WebStack nightly feed. There's instructions on how to find that on our website if you want to go to it. You can get all of our issue tracking, our feature specs, our design meeting notes, anything that we make public on entityframework.coplex.com. You can go there, you can fork, you can submit pull requests. We happily accept contributions from as many people as we can. But some people express concern here and there, particularly sort of bigger organizations, about the fact that we accept contributions and then we're open source. So one of the things we like to reassure people with is that the way it works is that you're going to submit your contribution to Entity Framework. You're going to add the ability to peek onto the diagram in the tooling. So you'll submit a pull request. Someone from our team will look at the pull request. It'll go through the same code reviews that anyone else on our team has to go through.
Same
nothing
code
gets
review,
committed
same
without
testing.
A code review. Same unit tests. You have to have written unit tests for it. We'll get you to write them if you haven't written them. You know, things like that. Mm-hmm. And then it will get committed to. Then one of our people will commit it to the repository on your behalf. And it'll have your name. Git supports that. We'll use Git for our source control. So we've accepted 25 pull requests. We've gotten 25 pull requests. We've accepted 21 from 8 different contributors. Those that aren't accepted are usually because the person kind of stops talking to us somewhere along the way and they just get left there. It's not because we didn't want, you know, or occasionally maybe because they were trying to do something that we don't think is a good idea and we want that to be an extension or something rather than in the core product. But typically that doesn't happen very much.
Yeah, a lot of that too is because we encourage contributors to talk to us first. So if you go and look at the contributing to EF section, the first thing is, you know, start a discussion, tell us what you want to do.
Yeah.
There's obviously some things that just they're not going to be useful to everybody, so we don't want to take them into the framework, at which point you're free to fork the code base, make your own build of it, et cetera.
Right. It's also fairly frequent that someone will say, hey, I've got this cool idea for Entity Framework, and somebody on the team will say, yeah, I spent 3 days writing a prototype for that here, or I spent a bunch of time thinking about that. Here's all the things I thought about that you need to consider. Mm-hmm. Yep. You know, so there's a lot of stuff, a lot of legs up that we can give by just by giving you all the information that we've got already that we haven't necessarily published or anything like that. You know. So the key part of all of that is that being open source only affects how we develop and not how we ship. So we have the same, when we ship Entity Framework, Microsoft ships Entity Framework, it has the same license Entity Framework's always had, has the same support agreement Entity Framework's always had, same code review, testing, quality process that Entity Framework's always had.
Right.
So when it ships, it's the same, and it's got Microsoft's backing.
Yes.
Except it's open source and people can contribute to it.
Yeah.
There's a slight difference. The code that is in the open source code base has an Apache license, Apache 2, right?
Yep.
But when we do ship it, it does get a Microsoft license. Effectively, Microsoft takes the open source code base and creates an official Microsoft version and ships it.
Yeah, so that's an important distinction. If you go and fork the code base and you make your own, then it's basically Apache 2 license. We don't support it.
Yeah.
But if you pick up, this is Microsoft's blessed build, like we release EF6 RTM, then you know you get a Microsoft license on it. It's actually true for the pre-releases too. If you go and get Entity Framework 6 Beta 1, which is available now, it's licensed from Microsoft.
Yes.
It's not an Apache 2 license. Yeah.
Yep.
So they're the biggest concerns we hear. We like to address them whenever we can. Because people think, open source, I'm never going to get open source in my enterprise or something.
Yeah. The other important
thing, really just a way of expanding the team.
It's a
great way to get additional folks writing code that then goes through the same processes.
Why isn't there enum support? Because nobody's written enum support.
Right.
If you guys write it, we'll put it in.
The other important thing that I like to point out too is, open source is great, but this has kind of been it's been a long evolution for us. Back in the 3.5 SP1 days, we weren't listening to customers that great, but we've slowly, we opened up the EF Design blog, we started posting feature specs on that. That was before a lot of us even joined the team that are on it now. Then we started doing more frequent releases, and then we started, we got to the point where we were doing, pre-releases every 4 weeks leading up, really taking a lot of feedback from the community.
Yeah.
And so going open source and having open source feature specs and stuff is really just the pinnacle of where we've got to so far with that.
And we've got, I think of 2 or 3 bug reports where a guy said, I'm doing this, it was working yesterday, and I update the nightly every night, and today it's broken. So yesterday somebody broke this.
Right? Yeah, we've had some great bugs.
So we're like, we committed some change and we broke somebody, and the very next day we got a bug report saying when we go and fix it. Like that's, being able to do that is fantastic.
Yeah.
The other thing too, the open source code base at the moment just has the runtime in it. The tooling for EF6 isn't going to be there, but after the EF6 release, we're planning to pull the tooling in as well.
Yeah.
So we'll have the tooling there, you'll be able to watch us develop on it, and we'll even accept pull requests on it as well.
Yeah. Cool. So upgrading to Entity Framework 6. As we said earlier, we effectively copied all the stuff from the .NET framework and moved it out into separate namespaces. So the biggest thing you have is that you need to change namespaces in your app everywhere. For the object context, that probably means you need to change all the namespaces. If you're using sort of EF5 and it's just DB context, there'll be going to be minimal changes probably. You might not have to change much or anything. If you're using object context, you probably have to change a fair amount because you moved all of that code is now in a different spot. Whereas with DB context, it's kind of still in the same place. But there is detailed guidance available on Codeplex. We'll try and get you guys the links. I don't know if we have it right now, but maybe put it in the notes for the show or something like that.
Yeah, we can do that.
So that you can link to it, and it'll tell you everything that has changed and what you will have to do if you're using this.
Can you show an example of that? Are you going
to
show an
example? We're about to upgrade this app, and it has some areas that touch this.
Cool. So.
The other thing that I wanted to call out here, while the namespaces have changed, the functionality hasn't. So object context, while it's in a new namespace, it has the same API surface with the same functionality. So you're not going to have to change the namespaces and then respond to a whole bunch of breaking changes in the code. We still have a really high bar for functionality breaking changes.
So. Yeah.
And that said too, this is kind of a one-time thing that we know is going to be a little bit annoying to people moving to EF6. But we think it's worth it for the long run to be able to ship quickly and make a lot of changes without forcing folks to upgrade to the new version of .NET. So,
right. Okay.
Okay. So, one of the bigger things for upgrading to Entity Framework 6 is that providers need to update. They have to do work to support EF6. How that impacts you guys is that if you're using a third party provider that's not the SQL Server or SQL Compact that we ship, and they haven't updated to EF6 yet, you're not going to be able to use EF6 until they do. And we've been talking with the provider writers for a long time now, telling them that this is coming and that we're updating things, right? And some of them have already released previews of their providers that work with Entity Framework 6 Beta, for example, which is like DevArt, for example. So that's one thing to look out for, is if you're using an Oracle provider or some starter base, or if you're a company that has your own, every now and then we talk to some people we didn't know about that have their own, then you're going to have to update the provider to work with your database and work with the native framework.
And again, for the providers, it's similar to users updating their application. It's generally just namespace changes and a few other little bits and pieces, and we have detailed guidance on that as well. I guess we should do this before we move on.
We probably should. Let's switch out to the app and update it. So Rowan's going to keep doing code for me because he's very protective of his laptop. But what we're going to do here is, the first thing we'll just do is update to the latest EF6 NuGet package. And you can see here that what the version Rowan's actually using, he's got his cursor over at the moment, is RC. Mm-hmm. So RC hasn't actually been released yet. You won't be able to get it anywhere. Well, maybe from if you go get our nightly build, I guess you'll get effectively it.
Yeah.
but you won't be able to get an official RC build yet. The Rowan's using this from his local file system. You can see on the left-hand side of the screen there, he's got the local package, the local folder. So he's going to update. This is just going to install the EF6 package, same as anybody's going to do. All right.
Excellent.
Now, what's going to happen is he'll build, and it should break because mm-hmm. he's using stuff that he can't use. In this case, spatial doesn't exist. See, the spatial types are looking in the wrong spot. Now, the way that you resolve this is if you go to your model, see, this is all code gen because it's the designer, right?
So
the TT files are generating.
Explain this because. So go back to that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So system.data is part of the .NET framework.
Mm-hmm.
So this is perhaps a little confusing.
Yeah.
Although it's system data, it's actually defined in the system data entity assembly.
Yeah. Okay.
Actually, ironically, the system.data.entity assembly doesn't have anything in the system.data.entity namespace. So this is a little confusing, but this comes from system data entity
yes,
assembly.
Which is part of the framework.
Part of the framework. So one of the things that happened when we installed EF6 is if you're installing EF6, it knows that it has a whole bunch of types that are also defined in the framework. So it'll actually remove the reference to system data entity because we now have all those types in entity framework.dll.
Okay.
So that's why we're getting a compile error because that assembly reference was removed.
Yeah. And this obviously this was all code generated when those references still existed. So what you have to do here is delete these templates because these templates are generating the incorrect code now. Now luckily, as if we would have known we were going to do this, we installed the Entity Framework 6 tooling here. And so you can go and add code generation item and you can get the EF6 code generator. Add these templates and they will generate code that gives you the correct stuff for Entity Framework 6.
So what we're going to see in this example, if I go and look at the listing class, is that now instead of system data dot spatial, it's system data entity dot spatial. So this is the move type.
Okay.
So that's effectively how. And so if you were using code first, you would have had to go and just change that yourself.
Mm-hmm.
But with the designer, you have to change the template that's generating the code.
Sounds like another good opportunity for a tool.
Yeah, absolutely. We've definitely in the EF6 tooling. This state that we're in, where we have 5 and 6, where moving to 6 is actually a bit of a jump.
Mm.
We've done a lot of work to say, okay, we need to support. We always support all past versions in the tooling.
Mm-hmm.
You can always open an EF4 model in the latest designer and that will work, but we've tried to really help folks understand like, okay, I can't use 6 because I'm using a third-party provider that doesn't support EF6. So we give you very clear messaging. When we show you that message, we'll shoot you off to a forward link to say, look, here's the third-party providers we know about that mm-hmm. support EF6.
Yeah.
And so we're really trying to help folks get over this step that we know isn't super easy to deal with.
Yeah. There's some extra steps in the designer when you get the new tooling. Like in the wizards, you'll start to see some new steps, like select which entity framework version I want to use. Do I want to use EF5 or EF6?
Mm-hmm.
And you'll start to see things like that appearing more and more to help you out in those sorts of areas.
Great.
Okay, so now we should be able to run, right?
Yep, let's run our app. Should see everything working.
This one wasn't too painful, but I mean, hopefully, if you're not using too much of the, like if you're not using any of the object context surface, you're probably okay.
Yeah, and in fact, in this case, we were using DB context, and if we hadn't been using spatial types, we wouldn't have had any problems.
So if you're just using sort of a fairly simple DB context model, you might not have to change anything. You could just upgrade. Okay.
Right.
So now that's how we've updated. So let's talk about some of the things that are new in Entity Framework 6. Once again, we wanted to call out here that there's a lot of these features apply to the designer and to code first. One of the bigger ones is asynchronous query and save. So this is we talked about earlier, going down, doing async with supporting the await keywords. We're going to show that later on. Connection resiliency is really important, but we're not going to show it today. We might mention some of the stuff around it as we go through, but it's the ability to automatically retry connection losses.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're going to get some sort of connection loss transient failure, if you're using some sort of high available database, SQL Azure or something like that, then EF will just seamlessly retry for you. until it works.
Yeah, this is getting more important as we move to cloud computing too, right? Where we're, you know, we're talking to services often over, you know, large distances. Right. The internet's involved. We're not. It's possible for things to drop out.
Yeah, much more. I mean, all these situations existed before. It's just far more likely now with these sorts of cloud scenarios.
So is that basically just retrying after
it's basically baked in retry logic and some, and we've, you know,
is it configurable?
It is configurable.
Number of retries.
Yes.
The time you want to spend.
So it's configurable and replaceable.
The ability to cancel.
Yeah, so it is configurable and replaceable. So there's an execution strategy. We have a baked-in execution strategy that works with SQL Azure and has a bunch of a list of reasonable errors to retry on. And you can set things like how long I'm going to retry for and the max number of retries and such. Okay. But you can also just create your own IA execution strategy and just plug it in and do whatever you want in there. So you can configure ours, and if ours doesn't give you the right configuration options, you can go and make your own, or maybe at some point there'll be a community project full of execution strategies, I don't know.
Right.
We're trying to do that with everything these days. Connection resiliency is just one example. We try to make everything pluggable, so if the default behavior doesn't work for you, you can plug in your own thing.
Yeah. The ability to specify how long it tries is I want that across the board in development, right? Because if you're developing and you can't talk to the SQL database on your own machine, you know in 3 seconds, maybe even only two, right? If it's 2 seconds later, okay, I must have missed something, and the default's 30 seconds.
And
so now you're sitting there for 28 seconds just,
That's painful.
You know,
a painful, painful 30
saying
seconds.
Saying things that, you know, can't be repeated. And it'd be nice to be able to just set that, you know, to no more than 5 seconds.
Yeah. So you can do that with this, well, with this in setting the maximum delay.
Cool.
Like so the easiest one is with the hours is that you can say, this is the maximum amount of time that I'm going to retry. The other thing is with the built-in retry policy, the first retry happens instantly as soon as the exception occurs, because most of the time that's just going to work when you get your when you get your first one. So if you just set a really low one in your local config file, for example, then it's going to you're going to be good.
And then obviously in production you'd beef it up and you might actually ask the user, you know, do you want to keep trying?
The other common one is to add like a different exception message. Like, I know I'm using some different database that you guys didn't support, or I'm getting this weird error and I want to retry on that. So you need to add that error type.
Yeah.
That's the other common one that we thought of. Code-based configuration is a new sort of way to define a bunch of configuration in EF using code with methods instead of in the config file. And it's actually one of the ways you can specify the execution strategy for connection resiliency. There's also a bunch of extra logging and interception points we added. So things like in Entity Framework 6, and we'll show a little bit of this today, you could intercept the DB command just before it hits the database and just after it comes back. And in fact, you could even take the query, modify it, and then let it go to the database different to what it was before, and things like that.
Okay.
And then there's a whole heap of performance improvements. Some of them even came from the community, who a couple of guys submitted some really good performance improvements on to the code base. These are code first only. Custom conventions, because code first, as anybody who's used code first knows, has a bunch of built-in conventions that it uses to map, like, you know, if you're property is ID, we assume it's the primary key for the type that it's on and things like that. Custom conventions is the ability for you to define all of those yourself. So you can say, I want to use, in my organization, all of our primary keys are called key. Sweet. Well, you can create a custom convention. I say all of my primary keys are key, and away you go. Should definitely help all those people who have some sort of DBA who's saying, this is the way you shall name all of your databases.
Right.
Then you can say, okay, I want to write some conventions so that EF will just name everything that way by default, and then I'm going to be happy.
Yeah, a common example we use is, I mean, in C#, we always do camel case property names. Some DBAs like lowercase with underscores in the middle, so you can write a pretty easy convention to split up your camel case to lowercase underscore.
Cool.
Yeah. And then there's insert, update, and delete stored proc mapping in code first is the other one. So these aren't in designer, obviously, with conventions, because the designer doesn't use them, and the designer already had the stored procedure mapping.
Right.
So this is just new in code first. In fact, we don't show it today, but code first has a really, really cool feature where it'll generate a stored procedure for you. You just say, I want this entity to have use a stored procedure, and it'll scaffold out an entire stored procedure for you, and then you can sort of tweak it as you see fit and insert, which is pretty good.
Yeah.
So there's also a whole sort of bunch of other smaller or features that we just sort of thought we'd list. I won't try and go through them all, but there's lots of stuff that we've been doing.
There's more than this too. This is kind of the next level down. You know, there's a huge list of things we implement.
Yeah, as well as just there's always lots of bug fixes. But the more important part about this screen at least is that all of these features just here were contributed wholly by people from the community.
Cool.
So this added the ability to add custom migrations operations and improve warm-up time. Like now, if you've got some, if you've got a really large model that was taking a really long time to do the first hit, where you have that slow warm-up period, the first query takes a really long time, that should be much faster for large and complicated models in Entity Framework 6, partly due to this, just this contribution from the community Sweet. Member, as well as a few other cool things like, you know, add pluggable pluralization service, so you could write your own pluralizer for your language and plug it in.
Okay.
Yeah. So a little bit about the release timeline. Beta 1's currently available, so you can go get it now. It's on NuGet. The runtime will work with 4.0 onwards, and as we said earlier, you'll get features that in EF5 that only worked in EF4.5, like enums. They will work on 4.0 in 6. We're kind of confusing it even more for this release, but hopefully it will be easier after this. Mm-hmm. Tooling for Visual Studio 2012, you can download now, the beta version of it now from Microsoft Download Center. And the tooling for the Visual Studio 2013 is built in the box in the preview. Right. If you get the preview, you get some tooling. And they'll keep getting updated as Visual Studio releases more. We'll RTM all of the stuff at the same time as Visual Studio 2013 RTM. So when it comes out, there'll be EF6 ready to go RTM as well, and for 2012 as well.
And would we expect Entity Framework updates in Visual Studio updates ever, or
possibly.
Would it
maybe yeah,
would it typically be that you'll update both designer and runtime?
The runtime will probably rev sort of independently of every, like we'll probably just release the runtime on NuGet whenever we think it's worthwhile, just all the time, and then whenever we do a tooling update, it'll have the newest.
So then we've definitely talked about putting those in the VS updates. It kind of depends what we're doing. If we have a really compelling feature set that we think is worth, you know, getting on people's boxes as quickly as possible, then yeah, definitely VS update is something we'll look at. But you know, for the most part, if we're just doing bug fixes and things, and it's, you know, it's not a super compelling set of features. You know, the kind of things that are useful for people to pick up, but they don't need it now, then I will probably just publish them out of band. But, you know, it's a new world for us. We're still working out how it's all going to work. It's a new world for Visual Studio too,
right?
We don't really know what people want either. Yeah. I mean, do people want Entity Framework to just go down to Visual Studio, or they want to go pick it up when they want it? Or, you know, so we're still trying to work that out as well.
Yeah,
you know?
it's who knows?
Yeah. And yeah, there should be a release candidate soon, sometime very soon for, you know, Visual Studio 2012.
So then the best place, so I get Visual Studio 2013 when it ships, I'm totally up to date.
Yep.
And then beyond that, there will be updates. What's the easiest way to keep track of that?
We've got a link to our team blog at the end.
Okay.
And we'll keep you updated on there.
Okay.
Yeah. We do an announcement post on the blog every time we're going to ship anything.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's probably the best way. Or maybe you could follow the Magical Unicorn Twitter account, perhaps.
Yeah, we've got links to all that at the end
as well.
Yeah. Just wanted to call out what Glenn said there, that while we're going to RTM with VS 2013, we want to get another pre-release out before we get to then. So EF is going to be doing an RC1 soon. We'll ship the RC1 runtime on NuGet, and we'll ship the tooling for VS 2012 on the Download Center as well.
Okay.
So you'll be able to pick that up. And then, like we said, the final release will just go with Visual Studio for that.
So some EF6 demos. Okay, the first thing I wanted to talk about was logging. One of the pain points for Entity Framework was I want to be able to see what the SQL is, and I need to go find SQL profile, or I need to fire it up, or I need to use IntelliTrace, or I need to do something like that. So one of the things we built into this version of EF is a really easy way to see what's happening under the hood. Like I just show me what it is already. So if you're trying to understand what Entity Framework's doing, you're trying to learn about it, or you've got some perf issues or something like that, this is a feature you want.
Or you're trying to understand T-SQL.
Or you're trying to understand T-SQL, perhaps.
That's the point.
Yeah, like, yeah,
you can
anything.
Learn quite a bit about SQL queries is done under the hood.
I always learned a lot from it about how Entity Framework works by seeing a link. By seeing my query and seeing what it was generating and going, wow, I can see what's going on here. Or how many times is it generating it was the other thing.
Mm-hmm.
Have I got five queries being fired off from this one thing I'm doing on Entity Framework, and I didn't realize that, which we can see today. So the way that we do this is the easiest way to do logging in Entity Framework is if you've got anywhere where you've got a context. In this case, we have an instance. We have this our real estate entities context, and there's a database property there, which has a log, which accepts an action of string. So you can give it any action and it will pass it, and we'll give it the string, formatted SQL string every time. In this case, Rome is just going to pass it a function which sends it to debug.write. If you were doing like a console application, you could just write, you don't need like the S lambda, you could just put console.write and it'll convert the method group to a delegate and away you go. But yeah, anything that anywhere
you
where you've got a function,
you
write it to a file. You could send it to your logging framework here if you want, whatever you want to do, right? In this case, we're gonna send it to debug.write, and then it's important to do too that this when you set up this log, it's specific to the instance of that that context instance, right, where you've set it.
Right.
So we'll show you a global way to do something similar later on. So now you can see here in our output window that we've got
cool.
all the SQL. And you can see there's a few cool things it shows you. Like it shows you 37 milliseconds, gave you back a data reader. You can see the timestamps that when it executed.
Mm-hmm.
You can see all of the, if there were parameters being passed in here, you'd be able to see what the parameters were. I'm pretty sure we write them out. So you can see you've got at P0. And then we say at P0 was 1. So this is the parameter that we passed in as well as what the parameter was.
You can see that in the query here.
Yeah.
P0 parameter.
P0, yeah.
Cool.
So the other cool thing about this that people that you can kind of discover is that query that Rowan just showed up there, this one? Yeah.
Yeah, this is our details page query.
Yeah, this is the details page query. And what you'll notice here, if Rowan scrolls down a bit, there's 1, 2, 3 different SQL, separate SQL queries being sent to the database. And that's because it's loading up a listing and then the listing's got points of interest, so then it's going to send another query to the database to get the point of interest,
mm-hmm.
and then it's doing the same thing for agents. Right? Here's like the lazy loading type scenario kicking in. So if you didn't realize this was happening and you have a slowly performing page and it's pulling in all these extra entities doing all these extra queries, you're like, oh, okay, my page is slow, I can see all these queries. If I added some includes in that first query so it's already got that data, it doesn't have to do these extra database hits, my page is going to be better. And that's like a super simple, easy way to work that out, right?
Yeah.
And much simpler than doing any of the alternatives that you've got today. So it is. It was there, and it's very good. The next thing we're going to look at is code-based configuration. So this is a bit we talked about earlier where you could use a code to set like your execution strategy and stuff like that. It's just a code-centric alternative to XML. Some people just prefer the code. I tend to prefer the code than the XML. So we just exposed a bunch of the stuff that we have in our XML file, in our XML configuration as code-based, mm-hmm. as code-based config. And then you would use it basically if you prefer code over XML. But also if you're doing something like you've got an IOC container, you've got a pluralization service that we had a contribution to allow, or you've got an execution strategy and you're going to wire that into your IOC container and have your IOC container put that into, like have a framework ask for the execution strategy, mm-hmm. and you're going to have that ask your IOC container and it's going to pass that back. So there's a bunch of, if you want to do things like that, then this is the way for you, right? Not everything's in here yet, but we add more and more as we go. There's two main ways to kind of access this type of configuration information. There's a DB configuration. You basically create a class in your app that inherits from DB configuration. In the constructor, there's going to be a bunch of methods where you can do things like set execution strategy. EF will automatically go find something that inherits from DB configuration and then do it.
Okay.
Now, under the covers, every one of those methods is basically just kind of a wrapper for a dependency resolver in EF where you give it something and that allows Entity Framework to resolve that dependency. So if you wanted to, you could sort of drop to this dependency resolver API if you found some sort of way, if there was some reason that you needed to. We add those methods to DB configuration for everything we can think of. So we expect that pretty much everybody is just going to use DB configuration, but this other building block that it uses is still there in public if you want to use it for some reason.
Yeah, the dependency resolver is useful for third parties too that are writing like a database provider or maybe a plugin for your application. It kind of allows them a point in the pipeline to say, I want to kind of sneak these extra dependencies in. Like a logging framework like Glimpse might be able to sneak in and say, can you just tell me about all the DB commands before they go to the database?
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of transparent to the user's application.
Yeah. And the important thing here, I guess, is that the config file always wins. You need to be able to change it in production.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so
see it in action.
Yeah, let's see it. So here, Rowan's just going to create a DB configuration class for us, and he's going to So you just inherit from DB configuration, then just use in your constructor is where you're going to call all these methods. So we'll be able to see sort of an example of some of the things you can do. So this is some of the things you can sort of replace in here.
Okay.
So there's a fairly big list there, as you can see. This set database log formatter, that would allow you to control the formatting of that log file that we saw earlier. So you can maybe change how that's written out. Here's the set execution strategy we talked about earlier. That'll allow you can give it an execution strategy and it'll use that instead of any of the ones that we've built in. In fact, that's the way that you turn on connection resiliency, is you come in here and you say use this execution strategy.
Got it.
And we've got one built in, so you can just use ours. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're going to do here is we're going to add an interceptor. Now, the interceptors are the things I talked about briefly earlier, which allowed you to intercept commands just before and after they go to the database. And what we're going to do here is we're going to create an nlog interceptor. So Rowan's going to install nlog.
Yeah, just for folks that aren't aware, nlog is a third-party logging framework that we're going to install.
Yeah. So with nlog, you can sort of write stuff to it, and then you can change a config file to determine whether or not the logs happen or where they go to. So you can just tell everything to write and then configure nlog at runtime to decide whether or not it actually happens, for example.
So this is here's one we prepared earlier scenario?
Yeah. So this is just an implementation of the IDB command interceptor. Notice at the top here we're just retrieving our nlog logger. And then the rest of this, after this, is each of the methods that the IDB command interceptor has. So you can see executing and executed for all of our commands that are going to go to the database. So as the name suggests, if you get it in the executing, it's just before, and executed is just after. So in our case, we're just going to log every time. And if an exception occurs, here's one of the advantages you get in here is that you can see when exceptions occur and what they are. So what we're going to do here is we're going to change whether or not we trace or warn based upon whether or not there was an exception. Right? If there's an exception, nlog is going to do something different if there wasn't an exception, which you then might configure to go to a different spot.
Okay.
Which means Rowan needs to now go and edit the config file so that you can put in some default config so that nlog actually logs something. Otherwise it'll just do nothing.
We're just going to use the defaults. They just write to a file in our root directory.
Yep. And so now if we run our app without build errors,
you've got to actually register
question mark in. Very good. So then you actually have to give it the interceptor that we just created and then run it. And now what will happen is nlog is going to create it. We're going to get that text file, and it'll have basically the same thing in it we saw earlier, depending on what you're doing, because it is at a different point in the pipeline. So if we go and have a look now, we'll see kind of the same thing. But if you're using code first, for example, with this interceptor, you'll see things like where code first asks the migrations history table whether or not a migration has been run.
Cool. Yeah,
which you're not necessarily going to see. So this is the same stuff that we saw before, kind of. Different point. The other thing is that's interesting in here is we could have modified this SQL before we sent it to the database. There's a context property that these methods get. So you could, for example, in executing, say, I know what the answer to this query is, set the result, and we'll never talk to it, and we'll never even go to the database. We'll just return that result back up the chain.
So what's the scenario when you would do that? Because the entity framework is generating that SQL statement.
Yeah, it is.
And then you're changing that. But so why would you do that?
So
and
one of the things
how do you make that?
One of the scenarios where I used the modification of SQL was testing connection resiliency on one of my machine. I wrote an interceptor that randomly raised an error that I knew was retryable. And then just test things like that. I can just sort of manipulate it here and there where I know I need to.
Yeah.
That's kind of obscure, I guess, but it was one way, and I've showed people this before, and they're like, I thought interceptors were just for logging, but once you showed me that you could use it to like test parts of your app and things like that by raising errors or doing things in weird ways, then that was kind of cool.
So that's one good example. If you were trying to write an in-memory unit test, you could actually write an interceptor that it knows what the SQL looks like, so it just captures that SQL and says, instead of hitting the database, like, here's the test data I want you to send back up to the app.
I see. So
The other one, I mean, this is very low in the pipeline, so you're basically getting a raw SQL string at this point. So you could do some string manipulation here if you wanted to do things like adding in a where that's always there, like always filter out anything that was soft deleted in the database. So you could do that. It's difficult because you're manipulating strings. We also don't guarantee that the SQL isn't going to change as you move forwards.
Right.
You know, if you wanted to, you could do that.
Okay.
What we plan to add in the future is interception a bit higher up when we still have the query kind of represented in an object model.
Yeah.
And at that point, it would be easier to go and say, like, you know, tack this where clause onto this table that I'm selecting from.
Sure. In fact, I'm pretty sure we did put the query tree interception in this time, right? So you can see query, like the link query tree, and intercept that. And we're just going to add more and more interception as we go forward. It's like connection interception. So you can intercept when connections are opened and closed by the framework and lots of things like that. And people like, as we said earlier, people like Glimpse are going to love this. The ability to be able to hook in, and they don't really want to do anything. They just want to see what's happening. And send it somewhere, right? And be able to do stuff. So it's maybe if you don't want to manipulate things, but you just want to see everything, and that's kind of part of the rest of the idea.
Yeah. The other important thing Glenn called out, if we go back to this example where we wired up to the log, we could have wired up this log to write to nlog very easily.
Right.
But the thing we'd be missing there, this log thing that we're wiring up is specific to this instance of the context and only within the scope of this controller. So. You know, we'd have to remember to do this on every time we create
it.
And this one, we're guaranteed to get everything, including the stuff that happens by Entity Framework before this is even touched.
Which is the other thing, because Entity Framework's going to do queries that have got nothing to do with your context, like hitting the migrations history table. So you're going to see everything in the interceptor, which is nice.
Cool.
Great.
So the next feature, last feature for Entity Framework 6 was async. So this is in .NET 4.5. We added the task-based. We added the async and await keywords, and we basically added async versions of all of the methods we have that cause a hit to the database, which allow you to await on that I/O operation. So if those of you who have done a bit about async, Ron and I both done talks at TechEd North America and TechEd Europe about async and ASP.NET and showed Entity Framework and all the way through. I/O is kind of where async really, really shines, so we added the async variants of these methods. So if you're trying to improve the performance and scalability of your web server, or you want sort of an easy-ish way to have your Windows Forms UI stay responsive whilst you're doing some database stuff, because if you're connecting directly to a database from there, those sorts of scenarios, this sort of stuff is for you. You can kind of do parallelism. We put parallelism on the end there. The important thing to remember with that is that you can't execute two queries on the same context at the same time in any framework. Like, the context is not thread safe.
Right.
So you could do some parallelism, but not on the same context instance if you really wanted to. It's kind of tricky. It's probably not, the thing is that once you've achieved all of the extra scalability and performance from just using async on its own, like the I/O to resolve the I/O, often those sorts of areas where you really thought you wanted parallelism, they're just faster now, and it's kind of not as big of a deal.
Yeah.
Unless you really do want parallelism for some specific reason. But
I think that's really important to call out. When folks like myself, when I first heard of async, I was thinking, oh great, I can like run two things at once.
Right.
That's really not necessarily what async is about. It's about, you know, while I'm doing something like waiting for the database to come back, you know, I have a managed thread in the CLR that's just sitting there waiting, not doing anything. So can I free that up while the I/O operation is happening?
Yeah. And for those of you, let's show some examples. I don't talk too much about the async. So it's actually really simple and sort of trivial now with ASP.NET MVC to kind of set up an MVC action. This could be done in web forms and Windows forms and stuff as well if you want, but. So with MVC, you make your action asynchronous, mark it as async.
Mm-hmm.
So you just give it the async keyword, just says this method is going to be asynchronous. And then we use await. And then on our listings, we can just go to list async. There's just a new method there in a new framework 6. And then now, when that operation goes off to the database, my free thread is freed up to accept some other request. It's also important to note the big thing that people stumble across here when trying to do this, and we had even a question a couple of days ago from one of the guys around us, was that can I only do to list and first and find async? Because they're the only two that are actual methods. Everything else is an extension method. So if you don't have using system.data.entity, you don't get all the other extension methods that we added for all the other async versions of all the other methods, like for each async, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a big thing that people think, oh, they've only got two lists. But we've actually got a whole bunch of other stuff that is just frequently when you rewrite your application, the place where you're writing your query is not necessarily where you've got system.data.entity referenced. And then because you've got that sort of in your context is where you've got that reference, but then you're using your context outside of that. So if you don't have that reference, you're gonna not find everything.
So we're not gonna run any load tests here or anything, but if folks wanted to see really how async can help you in a load environment where there's a lot of activity going on the website, then we'll include a link in the talk, we'll put it in the comments. But Glenn mentioned that we did async talks at TechEd, both North America and Europe, and we actually do a load test on stage and show that when we have a web server that's under the pump, async can really speed things up a lot. Yeah.
Particularly if you've got a mix of sort of some stuff that's I/O bound and some stuff that's not I/O bound, like it really, really helps in that scenario. Because
right.
those static pages, there's kind of always a thread through just to serve up some static HTML or whatever, you know,
which is
cool. So, and now absolutely nothing's going to be any different to last time because async doesn't affect the UI at all. so now absolutely nothing changes, except if there was a lot of load on this server, it would not chug quite so badly.
Yeah, and that's important. You know, people often misunderstand async, including myself at the start. You know, you make it async and you're like, okay, I'll run a performance test on my page. And this request is probably actually a fraction slower than it used to be. The benefits of async come when my web server's under a lot of load.
Right.
And freeing up threads actually frees them up to serve other requests.
Yes,
there's five people.
It doesn't make the call itself go faster.
No, it doesn't.
It means we're not using resources while we're not doing anything.
If there's five people looking at photos of cats on your website, it's probably not going to help.
Yeah.
But if you've got 5,000 people looking at cats on your website, maybe it does.
Yep.
At the same time, especially. Okay.
So we just wanted to kind of wrap up with some links to help folks out. We mentioned a few during the talk, so. I have a blog that I blog on regularly. You'll find stuff about EF6 on there now, mainly. You'll find Glenn on Twitter if you want to get in contact with him.
Mm-hmm.
Team blog, we mentioned that. That's where we do announcements. So when we release alphas, betas, when we publish roadmaps, when we RTM, we put feature lists on there, all that stuff. For EF5 is our current RTM release.
Mm-hmm.
So content for the current RTM release, msdn.com/data/EF. You'll find links off to whatever you need from there. Walkthroughs, videos, API documentation, all that stuff, that's the place to go to.
Right.
EF6 is currently pre-release, so you want to go to Coplex for that. There's some content starting to show up on our MSDN site, and by the time EF6 RTMs, there'll be all the EF6 content on there.
Right.
But while it's in pre-release, go to Coplex. User voice is where you can suggest and vote on features. You can do that on Coplex as well, but user voice gets the most traffic.
Right.
So, high number of votes, we tend to use that a lot when we're planning releases. If you want to stay up to date with the day-to-day stuff, then follow us on Twitter or Facebook. Design meeting notes when they're published, when videos like this are published, we'll just tweet, share on Facebook all the time.
Cool. So
they're great places to head to.
Excellent. All right.
Thank you.
Sweet. So we are now caught up on Entity Framework.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Absolutely.
There's lots more features, so.
Yeah, we should mention that too, actually. We showed a subset of the features here. We'll put links to our tech ed talks, which dig into EF6 a bit more if folks want to see more.
Excellent.
Yeah.
All right. So, again, back by popular demand, now we're caught up on Entity Framework. So if there are other things that you guys want to see, don't hesitate to let me know.
Yeah.
And
happy to come back if we really need more.
Yeah. So check out if you are just on 4, now you've learned what's in 5 and what's coming in 6. If you're currently on 5, you've learned what's coming in 6. And that's great.
Yeah, thank you very much for having us on. Yeah.
Thanks for coming.
Thanks for requesting us, you guys.
All right. Hope you enjoyed that, and we'll see you next time on Visual Studio Toolbox.